My name is David Byers. I'm an alcoholic. Any other alcoholics here? Any alcoholics here that would miss a party if they had a chance to go to a party? I mean, come on. Yeah, that's neat. I get to come here for that wedding. I'm glad to be here. Is any new people? Anybody new here with us or fairly new? New? Under 60 days or 90 days? Yeah. You're in a California speaker meeting now. Stand up and give us your name, will you?
You don't have twins.
Easy. You didn't even look pregnant. You've been drinking too much of that stuff, huh? Well, I tell you, how is it? How do you all like my tie? Yeah, it's kind of mixed. You know, it's going pretty good. I come all the way here. I got 3 suits, no ties. So Walt had to dress me to get here. You know, I mean, so make sure you listen to everything I have to say, you know. And then I got to tell you something that I was, you know, I don't know. I was kind of angry at AA as a whole, which would include you guys. And then I was sort of embarrassed at the same time today. I'll just share this with you to get started. I was in line in Phoenix to get on the plane to come here to Tulsa. And, you know, all the people, you get an A, B, and C and all that stuff with the Southwest. And I'm standing in the B line. I don't know why I'm not in the A line, but I'm in the B line. And, you know, I'm drinking a Diet Coke out of a white paper bag. I mean, it's like it's unmanly or something, you know. I mean, a man in Alcoholics Anonymous drinking Diet Cokes out of white paper bags. It was just, so that's how far I've come. See what you've done to me? So you have to take responsibility for that. That's what you've created here. I spoke here on Phyllis's 25th birthday in the year 2000 after the International Convention. And when Walt asked me to speak, I reminded him I already spoke here because they never asked me to speak twice in the same place. And well, it's been almost 4 years, and I guess some of you forgot me or something. And, you know, and that's just the way it is. I have to tell you right out as my story includes depressions and anger and resentment, jails, divorce, business failures, and that's since I've been sober. So a lot of times when I talk, people think I never get sober because I'm still going to jail when I'm a couple of years sober. It's like I kept telling those judges, I'm sober going to AA now. And they say, mm-hmm, and you owe. And, so that's just the way it is with me. I'm from the south, south side of Detroit. The story of my family is when I was about 5 years old, my mom and stepdad was having a party at the house. Everybody's drinking these long neck beer bottles at the party, and they all put them on the floor, I remember. And I remember going around as a little kid and taking a hit off those beer bottles. Oh, God, it tasted bad. So I poured them all down the sink. So my stepdad beat the hell out of me, which he had a penchant for doing anyway. And he beat me so bad that I let off drinking then until I was 8. And I was a well-wanted little kid, but nobody wanted me for long. So they got me pretty good in Detroit. So they sent me out to a place called Saugus, California, which is a San Fernando Valley north of Los Angeles. And I lived like 13 miles from the nearest gas station or anything, and then 2 miles up a dirt road on a hog ranch. Some of you follow football or racing, Aggie Genuine Hog Ranch, the famous guys. And it was one of my jobs to get up in the morning before I go to school when I was 8. 3 o'clock in the morning, the semis would come in with 32 tons of garbage, and we would feed that to the hogs, 10,000 hogs. You'd pitchfork it in. And every morning, all the Mexicans, all the wetbacks who worked there in those days, they would get, and they'd pass that bottle of tequila around. And boy, they'd all take a big hit, and I remember to this day, you know, I wanted to be one of the men, wanted to fit in, you know. And I'd take that tequila, and I'd take a big hit. Oh, God, it tasted bad. And I'd pass it on, you know, and the Armenians that ran the ranch and did all that, they drank Lord Calvert's, you know, and they'd pass that Lord Calvert's around, and I'd go get a shot of that, you know. Oh, I couldn't handle it. So I would do my chores, and go to school, and when I'd come home, they'd still be working in the pens and stuff, and I'd sneak in the Mexican's house and get the tequila and practice. I'll share with you that I think I'd done pretty good, or otherwise I wouldn't be your speaker tonight, you know. And I got where they'd pass that tequila around in the morning, and I could take a big hit and hold it down. You know, that tequila did more for me once I could hold it down and get some in me, you know. Then I could get, for me, I didn't get older or anything. I knew I was one of the men then. But I also got in touch with David. I could have conversations with David that I couldn't have without that. And I would talk to myself about, you know, I really didn't need anybody. I was okay the way I am, yeah. I didn't really mind all those people and all those beatings and all the stuff I was going through, all those maggots in the garbage and stuff. You drink enough of that tequila, you know you're going to grow up and be rich and famous. Yeah? You don't need anybody, so you just cut them off and have some more tequila. Yeah? I started going to, you know, I got to watch this. Walt said, no soul saved here after 9. And luckily my watcher says it's 6:15, so we're all... But I drank like that, and I started going to jail when I was 9 and 10. I started shooting people when I was 15, and that's kind of how I lived. I was an angry young guy, passed around, and a lot of juvenile halls and a lot of that kind of stuff. And just a world full of anger, and like to drink, leave me alone. Don't want to be part of anybody. I don't need anybody, don't want anybody, leave me alone. And I got married to this little 14-year-old girl when I was 16. I didn't have to marry her. I could have let the shotgun go off, you know, and went off to be a parent. And I had really good training, you know. And we had a child when I just turned 17, another child 18, another child 19, another child when I was 20, right at 21. I had 4 kids. I didn't even know where they were coming from. You know? Like I'd go to work and come home and, you know, say hello, and there'd be another baby. It's like, you know. And I mean, I didn't even recognize my wife if she wasn't pregnant. You know? Thank God I didn't have twins. Oh, yeah. Look what I got to look forward to there, twins. Judy, oh boy. And I always wanted to be happy, and I wanted to be rich and famous, and I wanted to be a really good parent and a good husband and, you know, all those things. And I would work all day. When you get married in 9th grade, when you're 16, they don't make you president of the bank, you know, so I'm a construction worker. And I'd go off and work all day. But you can't be making that money when you're 16 and 17 and 18 to be rich and famous, and especially when you're drinking and doing the stuff I'm doing. So I'd work all day and steal all night, you know. Because I knew if I had the right house or the right car or lived in the right place that I would be okay. And I knew I owed my family that. You know, I owed them more than I got. You know? Whatever it was, I owed, you know. So I would work and work and work. You know, I'm a great guy for saying, well, tomorrow I'm going to straighten up, get it together, you know. I remember... I was living in Hawthorne, California. I think I was 22 or 23, somewhere in there, a little suburb of Los Angeles. And I went to the store to get some bread, milk, and eggs for my family. Anybody ever do that? Just go, you know, get some bread, milk, and eggs. Coming back, I said, you know, dinner's probably not ready. I think I'll stop and have a quick one, shoot a couple games of pool, and go on home, you know. And I went to the store, got the stuff, went to the bar, shoot a little pool, have a couple drinks. And next thing I know, I got some guy shaking me by the shoulder, and he's saying, hey, man, where do you want out at? I said, I don't know. Where are we? And he said, well, we're coming into Tulsa. I said, Tulsa? Where's Tulsa at? He said, Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is not close to Hawthorne, California. And we're on some road, I don't know, and he was going somewhere, and he left me out. And there I stood on the side of the road coming into Tulsa with the bread and the milk and eggs, you know. I mean, I'm conscientious, you know. And I knew I was in trouble. I recognized being in trouble. I'd visited the trouble, you know. I knew I had to go home and face the music. I mean, I got a wife and 4 kids and a little plastering business. You know, any other self-employed people here? And, you know, I got responsibilities, yeah. But there's just also this little part of me that says, well, I'm in a little trouble. You know, I ought to sort of finish this before I go home. You don't want to rush home to face the music, you know. So I flip the coin. Heads, I go home now, or tails, I go on, and sort of finish this drunk and go home. I had to go 3 out of 5 to get enough tails, yeah. See, because I'm, you know, I mean, I ain't going to miss their party. I love parties, free food, all that stuff, you know. So I got through Tulsa and all that stuff, and I wound up in Peoria, Illinois. I had never heard of Peoria, Illinois. I'm not sure I ever heard of Tulsa, to tell you the truth. It was snowing. It was very cold. I mean, the bread and the milk and eggs was gone, and my little Camel cigarettes and my old T-shirt was gone, and my little money was gone, and it was snowing like crazy. And I remember walking around Peoria, Illinois, trying to find somebody to hit in the head and give me some money. I knew how to do that. See, there ain't a lot of people walking around in a driving snowstorm. You know, they know to get in. You know, and I was going in, and I tried to go in the train stations and the bus stations. I'd never done that, but I got started there then. And they were throwing guys like me out. If you didn't have a purpose, you had to leave. And I went walking around in Peoria not knowing what to do. And they were building a big building. I think it was a bank, going to be a bank, a big multi-story building. And they had these huge holes where they were going to take cranes and put these trees in, like fully grown trees, you know, for landscaping. And I remember I went and got some newspapers, and I jumped in a hole, and I covered up with the papers and covered up with the snow a little bit to make my plan, you know. I mean, can't be an alcoholic without a plan, right? So I'm in here making my plan, whatever it's going to be, you know. And I was just in there for a few minutes, and this little whiskered head looked over at me. Wino-looking dude. He said, "Hey, man, what are you doing in there?" I mean, what the hell does he think I'm doing in there, you know? And I said, "I'm making my plan." And he said, "Well, come on, get up out of there, and let's go down to the Sally and get some hot coffee and some soup. I'll get you down there." I remember standing up, looking up at that guy. So, "You want me to go to the Salvation Army?" "I'm David Bart. I'm a plastering contractor. Yeah? I have a very large house. I have a swimming pool in my house. Yeah? I have a new truck. I have a Cadillac. And you want me to go to the Salvation Army?" Remember, I'm the guy standing in the hole, you know, telling the guy that's trying to get me out of the hole this story. See? And it's like, you can't help a guy like me. See, there's no, you can't give me directions, you know. There was help around me my whole life. Yeah, so always somebody wanting to help me. But I can't hear. You know, I'll do it myself. I left there, I got to Chicago and did a bunch of stuff there, and, you know, long story stuff. And then I went back to California. I was gone 11 months. I went walking in my wife and kids' house just like I just getting home from the bread and milk and eggs. Yeah. So, because it was, you know, for a moment it was safe there, you know, it was safe until they all really recognized I was home. But somehow I could sweet talk her, and, you know, I was always afraid of getting thrown out, and always afraid of staying, and always afraid of not staying, always afraid and always afraid, you know. So I'd stay, and I'd go to work, and I'd get it together, and I'd work day and night because I want to be rich and famous, and I want to be a good husband, a good father. And I would drink, and I would be fine. Then all of a sudden, I'd get off on a drunk, I'd be gone. My customers would say, "Talk, hey, you need some work done, get David. He's the best if he shows up and does the job." Because I leave in the middle. I don't even steal the money half the time. It's not like, you know, I'm just on one. So that's kind of how I lived in the 60s. I was married and divorced 5 times. I married this old Catholic girl, see, and I'm not Catholic, but I married her, and her folks were real staunch. So every time I'd get off on a trip, they would go and they'd get divorced. California in those days, it took a year to be final. In between 1958 and in 1970, I was married and divorced 5 times, the same woman. Until I got to AA, I didn't know that some of you people got married, you got a divorce, then you married somebody else. You know? We just kept, you know, over and over and over. And, you know, I'm going to make it work. And I'm going to make it work. We were in a little separation, I was separated from her for a little bit, and I got a job offer in a place called Charlotte, North Carolina. And all through the 60s, I'm a plasterer. I did a lot of fancy stuff at Disneyland, if you've been there, and all that. I, you know, do a lot of stuff like that. So I got a job offer from a California drunk in Charlotte, North Carolina, to build a thing called Carowinds, where it was Rock Hill, South Carolina, and all that stuff. So I went to work there. I went by the wife's house, ex-wife or whatever she was then, kidnapped my 2 oldest sons and took off to Charlotte, North Carolina. To this day, I don't know why I did that. I just don't know. Lived in a singles-only apartment with the 2 boys. And had a spare bedroom. So I was really a trip then. I would go, and I was obsessed that the boys would look good going to school, 3rd and 4th grade stuff, yeah. And so I'd go on the weekends. I'd buy, you know, 10 shirts, 10 pair of Levi's, underwear. And they would get through that week. And then the weekend would come, I'd go to launder it. Well, shit, I ain't gonna leave the laundry. So Sunday night, I'd go buy a whole new outfit, and I'd throw these. When I finally moved there, I had an old bedroom just full of clothes. Wore one time, like, yeah. You know, trying to fit in and look good, you know. But I was there in Charlotte for a while, and that Christmas rolled around. I was there 5 or 6 months, and my oldest son called his mother, sisters, for Christmas. Told him where we were. And the next thing I know, here's the wife and my daughters, and right there in Charlotte. One more time, we were there together, you know. And, I don't know if any of you have been to Charlotte or anything, but I'm a California guy, and it's like everybody in the South, they all have front porches, and they have chairs and couches and stuff, and they sit on the front porch a lot. Well, we don't have that in California. So I wanted all over Charlotte to rent me a front porch, you know. And I had all those kids, but I mean, I had the biggest front porch in Charlotte and had a 4 or 5 bedroom house attached to it. I had 3 or 4 acres of manicured grounds and stuff. I had my own little forest, you know. I had all that stuff. And I think it was $425 a month or something. And or $320, whatever it was. And so we lived there for a while. And February 10th rolled around. And that's my belly button birthday. And the kids, you know, they've been there since Christmas, so we've been together 4 or 5 weeks now. And, you know, I'm working and da-da-da, you know. So the kids are going to have a party for Dad, you know. And that's neat. I go off, I get my cruise started, and we're going around, and I can't wait to get home for my party, you know. And, well, it's my birthday, so you stop with the guys and have a couple of shooters, right? You know, it's your birthday. And I got home late for Easter dinner. And I know I was late because they were just picking up the dishes. And I don't know how many days it is between February 10th and Easter in 1969. I don't know how many days it is, but that's how many days I've been gone. And the wife was angry. The kids were angry. My boss was angry. Seemed like he was getting a lot of credit card bills. It was his credit card with my signature, you know. And I like to drink on me, but I love to drink on somebody else, you know. And, you know, everybody was mad. So they started, you know how your family turns on you? You know, and starts calling you nasty words and saying mean stuff to you and everything. And one more time, they wanted to talk about me not drinking and tell me I had a drinking problem. I was an alcoholic and stuff. And I had one more time explaining to them, no, it was this rotten childhood. It was all those jails and it was all this. And, yeah, and it was too much responsibility. And, I'm not tall enough, whatever, you know. And so they had a deal that if I drank one more time, you know, that they were going to all leave me. I said, I could not drink anytime I want to. I got this stuff handled. So we made a deal that I wouldn't drink for 30 days. And if I didn't drink for 30 days, they'd all leave me alone about my drinking. But if I did drink during this 30-day period, I would go to some place called Alcoholics Anonymous. We made the deal. Well, you all know, a week or two later, I'm off on another run, and I get home from that. So we call. Actually, I didn't make the call, but my ex-wife then called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you pay your bets, right? You make your bets, and you pay. And I went out. I had my bar on my front porch. I went out and policed my bar and cleaned everything up, and they said two guys from AA was going to come out and talk to me, and so I waited about an hour later. These two guys come and brought them in, introduced themselves and everything. Asked them what they wanted to drink, and they wanted coffee. I said, oh, good. What do you want in it? They wanted, you know, cream and sugar. I got any kind of booze known to man. You know, put whiskey in your coffee. What do you mean you want cream and sugar? And I kept offering them all this stuff to put in their coffee, and they only wanted cream and sugar. I'm thinking, well, they sent the wrong two guys here, you know. So then they're talking to me, so they... Subsequently, we sit there and talked, and they smoked all my cigarettes. One of them would ask me a question. How do you get along with the family? While I was thinking up the suitable answer, the other guy would answer. Not so good. Yeah? How you doing at work? And they'd smoke, and they'd drink, you know. It's like, and then these guys started telling me things that another man doesn't tell another man. I didn't even know these guys. And I was embarrassed for them. And, I mean, it was, these guys were talking to me, and phew. Then they decided what I needed to do was go to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, fine. And they said, okay, they're going to go home, change clothes, and they'll come back and pick me up and take me to the meeting. I said, no, just tell me where the meeting is, and I'll meet you there. They said, no, we're going to go home, change clothes, we'll come back and pick you up, take you to the meeting. I said, they said, we're going to pick you up. I mean, I was going to the meeting. I either had to bounce these guys or I was going to this meeting. So they went home, changed clothes, and I didn't even know what change clothes meant, you know. It looked all right to me, you know. So they came back a little while later, and we went to this meeting in Charlotte, a big church. Got a lot of big churches in Charlotte. And I think there was about 1 million people there. I couldn't quite count them, but it looked like about 1 million to me. And we got started. We got in the back, and just when we got there, the meeting was starting. And these guys, they called for newcomers. And these guys picked me up in the aisle and sent me down this aisle of this church to this guy that was up standing here at the podium. He held up a big white poker chip. And he said, this is to signify that you're right now, a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he handed me the chip. And then he held up a red chip. And he said, we call this the stop chip. And if you don't drink for 90 days, you can earn this chip. Then he said, but if you choose to drink before that, swallow that chip. Then he didn't talk to me anymore, so I turn around and go back down the aisle. I get almost to the back. You guys won't believe this. sitting about, you know, three or four or five people over from where I was sitting, was my neighbor. The guy that lived right next door was right there seeing me. He was with you guys. And I got to tell you about my neighbor. He had just had me arrested. Just, I don't know, two or three days before that. See, you know, I keep telling you, I'm from California. I'm down here in Charlotte. It's like warm. Anybody moody? I'm a moody kind of drinker, you know? I get in moods, you know? I don't do things like other people sometimes or most of the time. You know, you leave the taverns, you go home, it's a warm, muggy Charlotte night. Them little bugs is flying around, sparking, you know? Yeah. And you get on your... You know, everybody down there had a riding lawnmower, so I had to get one to fit in, right? So you get on your riding lawnmower and you mow the lawn. 3-4 o'clock in the morning, you know? You put a pint of whiskey between your legs and you just sort of, you know, you smell the grass, them little bugs are going. You know? I mean, everybody else would mow there Saturday morning or something. Well, I'm not in shape Saturday morning, you know? So this guy called the cops. They arrested me for mowing my lawn. Now I'm in this meeting with him. And a little while later, they took a coffee break, and the guys that brought me are so excited, they want me to go meet this guy who's been here for 30 years. He's taking a birthday cake, and they are so excited. 30 years the guy's been here, and he ain't got it down yet. Okay? I get to, you know, 20 minutes of the meeting, I'm already seeing where the juice is, and what, you know, you got to know these things, you know. The guy's 30 years, and they are excited for him. So we go over and we meet him. Then we go to sit down. Then the next thing, they brought out a cake, like in the middle of this, and everybody's singing happy birthday. I did a lot of things, but I didn't stand around singing happy birthday to people, I'll tell you. And so I sang happy birthday, thinking, how is this going to help me? You know, me. And then a little while later, this guy got up to speak. And he's talking away. And I'm looking around still, and all of a sudden I'm listening to this guy talk. And, you know, he's talking about how he'd smacked his wife, you know. I'd smack my wife, too, but we didn't go out talking about it. He talked about how he treated his kids. I treated my kids like that sometimes, too. We'd go around talking about it. No, you better not talk about it. You know, we don't talk about stuff in my house. You know, he talked about being lonely. God, I knew about being lonely. You know, I thought he was talking to me. You know, this guy, I don't even know his name. I've never seen him in my life. He talked about how he'd be with his family, and he'd be there, and they would all be there, and yet he wasn't there with them. He just couldn't feel like he was there. Yeah. And he'd say some stuff. Some people in the audience, a couple of them laughed at some of this stuff. Yeah, I was thinking about shooting a couple of them. I mean, I brought my gun to my meeting, did you guys? Yeah. I mean, I didn't go to the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous without my gun. I mean, I don't go to bed without my gun. I don't take a bath without my gun. Why would I go to AA without my gun? Yeah. I mean, I'm not even sure who's after me, but if they ever catch me, I'm going to shoot them. Yeah. Then this meeting ends, and away we go. And then we go out in the parking lot, and we talk for a while. It seemed like my feet were going to sleep. And the next thing I know, we're going to ice cream. My whole life is falling apart. Everybody is mad at me. Nobody wants me, you know, nobody wants me around. And we're going to ice cream. So we go to ice cream. So then we leave there, and I somehow survived that. And I got home, and my boss and his wife and my wife and the kids, everybody's so excited that I went to this AA thing. And these guys took me, gave me their phone numbers, said they'd be glad to pick me up the next day to call them, and they'd be glad to take me to a meeting, gave me a little directory. And so I started going to AA. I went to AA every Tuesday and every Friday. Seemed like that was enough to keep the heat off, you know, Tuesday and Friday. Now, that group is similar to this group. See, I already caught on when I first come here tonight. That was 8 o'clock meeting. I was going there, too. If you get there about 7:45 and get your parking spot, you know, try to park way away from people so you don't have to talk to them, you know, and then you come into meeting to get your seat back in the corner somewhere, they got people out there going to come say, hi, how are you? You know? Ask your personal questions, you know. Hey, how you doing? You know? I don't answer personal questions, yeah. And they had them every time, you know, no matter what door you went in, there they were. You know? Then, at the end of the meeting, They would pass this basket. Everybody put a buck in, change if they had it, whatever. Then you stand up and hold some guy's hand and say the Lord's Prayer. I'll share with you, I ain't heavy into prayer. And if I did say a prayer, I'm certainly not going to hold one of these guys' hands to do it. In the room with everybody. So I invented, I don't know if it's on your literature table back there, I invented the David Barge system of Alcoholics Anonymous right then. I mean, a couple meetings and I had it going. See, the meeting starts at 8, you come in here 5 or 10 minutes after 8, then you don't have to answer all those personal questions. Yeah, ain't nobody there going to ask you a question. When they pass the basket, you put your buck or two in, and you get out of here. Otherwise, they're going to grab you, you're going to say a prayer. And then if they grab you for the prayer, you're going to go out in the parking lot till your feet go to sleep, and then you're going to go to ice cream. Yeah? Yeah, but you got it all down. Yeah? And then the people that miss you at the beginning are going to ask you at the end these personal questions. Hey, how you doing? What's happening? Yeah. So I come a little late and left a little early. Come every Tuesday and every Friday because I was going to earn that red chip. Now, I was a little irritable and discontented, as our book talks about. You tippy-toed around my house because Dad ain't drinking. I was running crews in 3 or 4 states there. I probably fired 30 guys. I don't know whether they needed it, but at the moment, it always made me feel better. Because I was going to get that chip. And I got that chip. The truth is, I got it on the 89th day they gave me my 90-day chip. And I was so proud of that chip. I showed it to every bartender between North Carolina and California. I said, looky here, I'm a graduate of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah? And you want to know about AA, you ask me. They've got educated people, and they've got beautiful women. You know, anything you want, you just talk to me about it. I got back to California and was doing my thing, and you know, I forgot that wife and 5 kids now. Don't ask me about the 5th one. I forgot those people. I kept losing them, you know, and then they sold all my stuff and came back, and I caught a strangler again, and they put me in jail, and we went through that, and I got out, and I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous in Manhattan Beach. The people in North Carolina had called them, because when I got to the meeting with the directions, there was some boob I'd never seen in my life standing there saying, hey, how are you? How you doing? I'm asking them same personal questions. And you stay for the whole meeting, which was an hour and a half. Some guy's going to hold your hand and say a prayer. It's just the same things. Now, when I was in North Carolina, they had some kind of steps they were working and all that, but that had that G word in it, so I didn't get too involved in them. They had some kind of books they were selling, but I had a lot of books, so I didn't buy one of those books either, you know. And they had the same books in North Carolina, in Manhattan Beach that they had in North Carolina, which tells you they're not a good seller, you know. Yeah. When they're not even original, you know. So I would go to meetings, and I worked the David Barge system in this Los Angeles area of California. And I'm from the class of 1969, the class of 1970, the class of 1971, the class of 1972. I would come in and sit with you guys. I'd get 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and I would leave. And I would be here because I heard, don't drink. Don't drink no matter what. And I would come here and I would come in my corner and I would just be here not to drink. And I would go as far as I could without drinking. Just as far as I could. And then I would reach a point and I would drink. I didn't hold your hand to say the prayer. I sat separate. And I came. And then I would make it for a time and then I would be gone. And then I'd be back. And then I'd be gone. One day I was sitting in a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and some guy said, if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and you're sick and tired of having all that fun out there, you're in the right place. Yeah. And I remember standing up and giving him one of my first AA pitches and told him where he could stick his sick and tired because I was not drinking and I was restless and irritable and discontented, you know, and I left. And I went and either got me either a 5th of whiskey or a quart, I'm not sure which, and I went to drink that, you know, bottle of stuff. And we had an old-timer in that meeting in those days to talk about if you be alcoholic, it's the first drink to get you drunk, not the second, not the third, not the fifth, it's the first drink. It's kind of like getting run over by a train. If we all leave here and we go park our cars on the train tracks and the train runs over us, it's the engine that's going to kill us, not the caboose. And it could be the 3rd car or the 5th car. It's going to be the engine. If you're fairly new or something, please just take my word for that. You don't need to. I'll do the experiment. You don't need to go do that. And he'd say that, so I heard that so many times. So when I went to drink my whiskey, I had one drink one night and one drink the next night and one drink the next night just to prove I could do that. I know 6 days I drank either that fifth or quarter of whiskey that I had. On the seventh day I rested. Yeah. Well, you people that laugh at that, I know your attitude now. Give yourself up here. Yeah. Yeah, see. And I can't tell you too much more about 1972. I wound up in a little flop house motel room that my little drinking plastering partner put me in. I had everything to drink imaginable, and I'd sit in that room, and I would drink and drink and drink. And I'm a sociable kind of guy, and so then sometimes I'd go and they walk to the bars, and I'd walk, you know, miles to get to a bar. My drink of choice then was a double shooter of tequila with a lot of hot sauce, and I never want to put enough hot sauce in it. I don't know what happened to my taste buds here, you know. I guess the same thing happened to the cars and the wife and the kids and the clothes and the respect. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, my taste buds wasn't working. I'd always want to wind up shooting the bartender because they didn't have enough hot sauce. I never, it seemed like an alcoholic would shoot them because they didn't get enough tequila. I needed more hot sauce. And they'd take me to jail and they'd put me in there, and then they'd get my partner, would get bail me, and they'd get me out of there, give me all these warnings, and I'd go back to the motel and I would drink and drink and drink. And then sometimes stuff come out of the wall and you could hide from it, and sometimes you just had to shoot it, you know? And when I started shooting it, they would come and take me over to one of the general hospitals there in the lockup wards, and they would lock up and put all that stuff in me. And I would stay, I don't know, and then I'd stay there, and then I would go home, and then I would go to jail, and then I'd go to the room, and then I would go to the hospital, and that's kind of what I did. In one moment, I don't want to be dramatic, but I don't know, day or night, I just don't know. I was laying in that bed, and I knew life was over for me. I knew it was over. I couldn't run anymore. I couldn't lie anymore. I couldn't drink anymore. I just couldn't go on. So I decided to kill my ex-wife. Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but it had to be somebody's fault that I felt this bad. See, I already told you from when I was a little kid, I just wanted to be rich and famous and be happy and joyous and free and be a good husband, a good father, be respected. That's what I wanted. So it had to be somebody's fault that I felt this bad. But see, I had a problem. Now I got this wife and I got these five kids. Should I shoot her and myself and let the kids fend for themselves? Should I shoot her and some of the kids? You know, if you're a parent, some days you love more than others, you know. You know, and run off, you know. Should I shoot her and me and just a couple of the kids? I mean, these are major decisions, you know. I had drank myself into a spot where I couldn't make the decision and got out of the bed and go to the bathroom. So I just sort of went where I was, you know. I got where I couldn't make those kind of decisions. And somewhere in there, the serenity prayer that I heard that you guys came in. I heard that serenity prayer, and so I said, you know what I'll do is I'll go to AA and I'll sit with you guys one more time. Because as long as I came here, when I was here, I never drank. It was only, you know, I'd reach a point. So I'll come and sit with you guys, and then I can make the decision who to kill, who not to kill. And I think it says that in the long form of the third tradition. So on December 18th, 1972 is the date that I take for my birthday. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. One more time. And I remember standing in my corner, a place I'd AA meeting I'd never been. You know, standing back there, and it was a night meeting, and there was a basket, and people were asking questions, and you'd go to the leader, and then the leader would read it, and questions, and people would answer the questions. And one of the questions was, I have 3 months or 6 months or something, and I notice when I'm driving my car that people pull out on me, and it makes me angry. What should I do? I suppose the answers were live and let live and easy does it and all that stuff, you know. I jumped up in my corner and said, run the SB off the road and take a tire iron to him, which I felt was the correct answer, you know. And I'll have to share with you at this time, I was stood there in these pants and shirt and stuff that I'd been regurgitating in and defecating in and urinating in for a long time. I have very long hair. I know you'll find this hard to believe. I had no teeth. Sociable guy like me, people always want to kick my teeth out. And what's worse, they did. Yeah. I had sores all over me. I had a full beard. I had a long, long green overcoat on me. And my head down and my hand in my pocket and my gun. Because when you make the decision to kill, you got to have your gun. And different from this group, I know this for a fact, I want to share with you, after that meeting, not one person ran up and threw their arms around me and said, geez, David, it's good to have you. You're the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous. You would have did that, wouldn't you? Yeah. And so I embarked on my meetings. And I'm the guy that came into the meetings that I talked to myself more than the meetings talked. And I guess I went to meetings when they didn't have meetings. I was a regular attender of a Tuesday noon meeting, which would meet just a closed women's group. I don't really know what they talked about. I don't remember them hugging me either and telling me, geez, David, it's good to have you. You know? And I went to meetings like that for a long time. I was in a meeting, at a little speaker meeting on a Tuesday night at the same little club, and it's in February now. I'm still dressed exactly the same. I'm showered or, still coming around the club. Sometimes I got pretty sick and they called the paramedics. They tell me now they was wishing the paramedics would have kept me when they took me away because I kept going on DTs. And I'd come back, I was standing in this meeting and they asked for newcomers. And for some reason I jumped up and said, David, and sat down. Don't even know why I did that. A little while later this guy was talking, a little wino guy with a beard. Might have been that guy that was in Peoria all those years ago. I don't watch out for winos. Are you a wino? These winos with beards are after me. And he got to talking and he said, hey, where's that new guy David at? Where's David at? And he singled me out in the crowd. And he said, David, what you need to do and what I want you to do is I want you to act like a little sheep. And I want you to get right in the middle of this flock. And old cunning, baffling, powerful won't get you. I almost blew his head off. I'm the kid from the Hog Ranch. I'm the kid who ran all those motorcycles, all those Hells Angels and stuff for years. I'm the kid who's been in all the... I know what guys do to sheeps. And this guy's telling me right in front of everybody. Act like a little sheep. You got to be kidding me. Hard to be a tough alcoholic and sit there with your hand on your gun and everything and somebody say that to you and you start crying. Hard to be a tough guy. Hard to be a tough guy and start crying. You don't know why. Later that night, I went home, and I didn't know I was going to tell this story, but I guess we got time. I went home, and I was in my little room, and knock on the door, probably midnight or 1 or something. I look out. I went to run out the bathroom window and jump and split, because you get a little paranoid sometimes when you hear noises, And I thought, oh, I ought to see who it is, Novel idea, And it was this little guy, this Joe Moats. I didn't even know his name. The guy that was speaking at that meeting was at my room. So I opened the door. He told me he was there on a 12-step call. That's why I didn't know the dates. That guy's still sober, a roofer. And he told me he was there on a 12-step call, and he seen me wandering around the parking lot. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I hadn't had a drink in 6 or 7 weeks, and when I could, I just couldn't sit still. I'd wander. I'm wandering the alleys and just on the move, And he asked me if he could come in before I could get out and know, I have company coming or something. It's like, he's in, He asked me how I was doing. I said, well, I'm having a hard time sleeping. You got to tell him something, right? He looked around and said, well, if you turn the lights off and the radio off and the television off, maybe you could go to sleep. Old timers are smart. Now, how are you going to turn the radio off and the lights off and the television off and I'm going to be just with me? You got to be kidding me. How am I going to do that? I'm too afraid to do that. Just to be with me. And he asked what I was going to do with all that booze. I had glasses and bottles of booze everywhere. What are you going to do with it? I said, I don't know. I can't drink and I can't throw it away. He said, well, I see you coming to these meetings and you're hanging around and stuff. And we've been watching you and we know you keep coming. And he said, you either got to drink it or throw it away. You don't need to live with it anymore. So I said, well, I guess I'll throw it away. A decision I couldn't come to on my own. Took an AA person to give me the choice. Never told me to throw it away. But he gave me a choice. Nobody had asked me, give me choices for years. I'm told what to do. Get in that cell. I'm told what. Nobody asked me. He asked me, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. I can't drink it. I can't throw it away. I can't run. I don't know. So then he asked me if he could help me throw it away, and I says, yeah, let's throw it all away. Well, the bad part about this story is he went in the toilet tank and got my hide out and threw it away. How did he know it was in there? And just another important question, who was I hide it from? I lived by myself. I mean, I didn't have visitors. We didn't throw pool parties and, you know, bingo and, you know. So we poured all the booze out. And then he said, said he'd watch my place. I mean, it's a little flop. I mean, there's nothing to watch. He said, maybe you go take a shower. I might not have had a shower in months. I mean, I know in 6 or 8 weeks, at least, maybe, you know, who knows. I don't know, because he was there, and he said he watched my little stuff. And I did that. I don't know. You know, when I went in, I took a shower, and when I came out, he had taken the sheets from my bed and threw them in the trash. He had clean sheets on my bed. Come little wino. This guy I never knew. He went to this 12-step call he was on, and he got clothes from that guy. They were way too big for me, but they were clean. And Ronnie said, hey, you could put these on, man. We could throw yours away. You don't need them anymore. This guy had been sober 20 years. 20 years in AA. And he's at my house at, hey, don't need me. What the heck's he doing there? Would I do that? Would I do that today? And that's my big question. Where do I go? So he stayed there and kind of watched me, and I went to bed and went to sleep, and, you know, woke up, and the next day he was still there drowsing. And, you know, he left, and I'd sort of shaved and cleaned me up. I think I cut myself more than did anything, you know. And I went back to the meetings, and I continued to steal the money out of the baskets. Just because the guy gave me life don't make me honest with it. In those days, in the early 70s, people in AA, California, they'd say, put a little in or take a little out. Well, I had to live. I always took a little out. Boy, that's expensive money when you get it sober. I remember I got a 5 from this one meeting and put it in the basket so I could take change for a 10. I got to eat lunch. This dodo next to me grabbed the basket and went on to the next guy. So I went to the resident old-timer, named Frank P., and explained how you guys stole my money. And he put his arm around me and said, well, that was probably God's will. I didn't even know God knew I was here. I mean, that's, you know, something to ponder there, isn't it? In those days, they said if you pick up coffee cups and ashtrays and stuff, that you'll stay sober. I heard them. See, because years I'd been in and out of here, and they were saying, don't drink no matter what. And I heard them, but I couldn't do that. But I could pick up cups and ashtrays and stuff. And they had a guy who worked in a little kitchen at this club after some of the meetings, and he'd go and wash the coffee cups and stuff. And I went back and said, I'm just going to start washing all the cups and stuff. And he said, no, this is my commitment. I just showed him my gun. I never pulled there any. I said, no, I'm washing the coffee cups from now on. And that's how I got my first commitment. I don't know how you got yours, but then I would wash the coffee cups, you know. And that's what I did. And I did that. And then I heard in there, you know, if you don't drink and you wash the coffee cups, you pick the chairs up and set the chairs up. And, you know, when I set the chairs, they were in a straight, perfect line, too, I'll tell you. And if you went on 12-step calls, you know, and so I would go on 12-step calls, and they said always go with somebody, but I'm a lone ranger. I'm, you know, I sit a little separate still. I still ain't holding hands saying too many prayers and stuff. So I go on that, and I go on this guy, he's got a rifle, and he's got a needle stuck in his arm. He's going to shoot his arm off, and he's going to shoot me. And he's going to shoot his arm off, and he got all mixed up, and I took the rifle, and I hit him in the head, and I got him in the car, and I was taking the meeting, and he kept trying to get out, and I kept hitting him with the gun. I got him down to the meeting, and they took him, got him stitched up and everything, and see, because I heard if you did that, you're going to stay sober. He's not loving my fellow man. When I did this, is not a 12-step call, you know. And, you know, I'm going to get mine, you know. And finally, I did that. There's a guy that two old guys were talking to me, two old timers, and they went and got this guy, new guy, and brought him to the meeting on his first night. And one of the old timers went home and had a heart attack and died. And I went to that new guy on his first day, and I put my pistol right down his throat. I said, if you ever drink, I'll blow your head off. Because I like this old timer, you know. And he's got over 30 years of sobriety, coming up on 31. I feel in some small way that I contributed to that. Yeah. Because it's like, I'm going to do what's, you know. And then, see, but everything's been given to me here. Everything's been given to me because you guys gave me the power to show up. You took me in. I'm not sure you was happy about it, but you took me in. Yeah? You took me in. in a... I didn't know how to get a sponsor. They kept talking about getting a sponsor, but I couldn't ask you to be my sponsor because I didn't have anything to offer. It's like I ought to have something. I never got that I didn't need anything. You know? And so they appointed me one. And I got a sponsor. And I had seen him and everything, and he was all right, you know. I kind of liked him. And then he said, we need to have a meeting. And we got a meeting, and then he said, well, bring your big book. Well, I don't have a big book. So I had to get a big book. And then we go over and talk about these things. And then he told me I had to stop stealing money out of the basket. Cold turkey, you know. I mean, I want to take her off here or something, you know. I didn't even know he was stealing, but he knew I was stealing the money, you know. Everybody knew. And I had to start working to pay it back. And I said, I don't know how much I owe. And he said, don't worry, I'll tell you when you get there. And we had to do some things. He told me at night that we had to pray. We had to get on our knees and pray. I didn't want to stand in the room with these boobs and hold their hand and pray. Now I'm with one guy, I'm going to get on my knees. Man, that's hard. That's really hard. It wasn't as hard as the way I was treating my family, though. It wasn't as hard as the way I was treating wife. So I did that, and I don't remember meaning it. And then he told me to go home and say my prayers every day. And he told me it didn't have to meet. And he said the main thing about prayer that you have to know, because I wanted the secret. He said, well, you got to start. You got to start. You know? And then you don't have to, and then just don't stop. Yeah, just do it. So I went to my little room and I would kneel in front of the toilet and say my prayer. Seemed like it was a comfy spot, right? Yeah. And that's how life started for me. My sponsor died when I was about a year and a half sober, and I was devastated, and I ran off from California because I ran off my life always. I wound up in Midland, Texas, and went to jail there for a while, and I got out of there and I went to Charlotte. Yeah, and went to jail there sober. Yeah. Big story, so, you know, like making funny now. It wasn't funny at the time, you know. And I stayed sober. I got out of jail in Charlotte, and I don't know where I got on this, but I was walking around Charlotte, and I either needed to drink or run or something. You know, I'm a year and a half sober, and I've messed everything up again, you know. So I went to an AA meeting. You know, God got me to the meeting. And I went there. It's this huge meeting. And a guy said, you know, my name's Dave, I'm an alcoholic. I said, hi, Dave. You didn't do that in Charlotte, North Carolina. You do that in California in those days. A little while later, they read just the five steps, not chapter five, just the five steps. I was the only one applauding. Then they asked if there were any visitors. I stood up and said, I was Dave. I'm from California, which to those people meant I'm from Hollywood. And at the end of that meeting, they said the Lord's Prayer, and I grabbed hold of these two old boys. And them old boys down there don't hold hands from guys from Hollywood. And hell, I said the prayer. And I left there. And I was like devastated. You know, I went to fit in one more time. And all that ego stuff that happens with me. And this little gal came over and introduced herself and said, it was nice to have me at the meeting and stuff. And that there was a meeting down the street that she thought that I would like. No direction, you know. Different group or whatever, you know. And I left that meeting and I didn't know what to do. And it came on me then that all my life. I've showed up wherever it's been, and I'd showed up here in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. Give me. Coming to you to get. Whatever, give it to me. I need it, I want it, or whatever. Give it to me. And I got from that experience that, no, I come here to give what I got. Sometimes it's a lot, sometimes not very much. But I can show up in Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis and give what's been given to me. See, and that's all I'm asked. That's all I'm asked. Yeah. So what I want everyone here to do is get in the middle of the flock, act like a little sheep, and no cunning, baffling, powerful won't get you. Thank you. I love you.
We hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.